Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Lowdown. Today I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by the CEO of the Association of Sporting Directors, Mr. Dan Parnell. Dan, big warm welcome to the show.
Thanks, Connor. Thanks for the invite to join. Delighted to finally get on.
Dan, as we begin with every guest that comes onto the show, could you please take us through your earliest football memory?
Earliest football memory. One of them was from when I was playing. Like I remember being on the pitch, it's Water Park Road, and one of the boys turned up. I must have been 5 or 6. He ran into me, pushed me off the ball, and did a turn. And he was wearing a Northern Ireland shirt in the middle of Birkenhead in the northwest of England. I was just looking at this kid, and I ended up being one of my best friends, Daniel Swift. So that was when I was about 5 or 6. And then earlier than that, I can remember one of my first Everton games, and I must have been about maybe 3, and I'd just be walking around the pub at maybe 11:30 in the morning for a 3 o'clock kickoff. When my dad had a few pints, I'd be eating these sausages that the pub used to be giving out and just knocking around the pool table, just messing around, really, just being a nuisance as a little toddler. I can remember those days quite clearly, to be fair. A lot of days just under the tables messing around with the other kids.
Fantastic, and obviously, look at the growth of the game throughout your time as an Everton fan. We can really do a whole separate podcast on that. But you're joining me just fresh back in Liverpool from coming from Tanzania, and a huge reason as you were there is obviously aligning footballing structures there. And a big part of the show today will be speaking about the role of sporting director. But we're just speaking off air about the growth of the ASD since you guys first co-founded it 8 years ago. In 2017, co-founding the Association of Sporting Directors at the time, Dan, what was the gap in the game that you felt needed filling most urgently at the time?
Well, at that point, they had a number of guys that had identified there's a need. So most notably, likes of Dan Ashworth, who had been technical director at the English FA, Mike Rigg, who's now academy director at Birmingham City. These guys got together with other prominent technical directors, sporting directors, and they just wanted to understand what each other was doing. And Dan led some of that at the FA. They created the Level 5 Technical Directors course at the FA. And when these guys completed the pilot, they identified that there was a gap in bit of professional identity, but also this opportunity for knowledge exchange. So because the sporting director was evolving and many were operating in isolation, and when I seen this, I tried to think about how that connects to research. So what sociologists would call a structural hole within a network. They needed to create something that allowed people to keep connecting. So the ASD, this is a bit of a fancier term, a Latin term, called tertius jungens. It's called this the term for the third who joins. So the ASD was almost like a network to join two people and help them be successful, whether that was connecting across clubs, across countries, but even sports. So these guys set that up. Mike Rigg founded it. And then over the years, I'd engage with Mike. He'd been involved in my research. And ultimately, I probably interviewed probably about 15 sporting directors at that time. And I think just by not sharing what they'd shared with me, that was on the record, off the record, handled myself well with research, been relatively bearable company, I would say, for them. They asked me then to take on the association. So really privileged. And the ASD then just allowed sporting directors to share their insights, to build this and help professionalise the practice. But also collectively, do a lot of work around shaping the role. So when you go on the ASD, Connor, you see the three things: support, connect, develop, and we try to live by those day in, day out. But around that, we know in any innovation, we need to keep sharing best practice. So we try to engage, inform, and inspire positive change too. And that's more behind the scenes through implicit work we do through the podcast, through insight articles, through our knowledge exchange events. So if you went back to the very early days and the past 6 weeks, actually, I've gone back to some of the founding members in particular and just said, what was it for you that what helped drive the ASD for you? And for them, it was just a confidential peer network. So it saved them from repeating costly mistakes that had already been made. It provided this professional but also personal support that I don't think had existed massively in football before. And that's the age of technology that was also like fast forward some of this. And then I think originally, if you look back maybe 30 years, 20 years, there was a bit of anti-intellectualism as well. But I think now we've got some really strong, independent, personal developers, people who are learning and want knowledge exchange opportunities. Now we take some of that for granted. But if you go back 20 years, that it wasn't that easy for some of these guys stepping into executive roles to be able to do that.
Yeah, it's an interesting one there because leaning on the ASD, it has, and it currently is for me, one of the leading, I would say, and most influential leadership networks of footballing professionals worldwide. And then you speak about the mantra to support, connect, and develop, and it's something which I've seen very closely here at the North American edition in Chicago last January with Joel. But you just touched upon it there. Why do you think it was nearly such taboo for these networks to be around in football in the first place? Because it is interesting enough, you do see these C-suite leaders, of course, they have to put on a show of bravery each and every day because running a football club in the modern world is a 24/7 endeavor, Dan. But why do you think it was such taboo to form such networks or alliances like this in the first place?
I really think about any competitive industry, very nature of that. We would talk about intellectual property. We'd talk about research insights, just and almost all the nous that people have from being within a club. In any organization, people wanted to protect that, and there was almost like a fear of the unknown. But also for some of these guys, rightly and wrongly, they were also just in these leadership roles without any support whatsoever. And we see it now. It's still in other industries and some roles in football. Without support mechanisms, people, sometimes the best thing to do is just keep your head down and sometimes not let people know how much you don't know. I'm not saying that's right, but these guys had to, they had to protect themselves. They had to surround themselves with people that they could only trust, regardless of skills and competencies. A really challenging period, I would say, and that's not exclusive to everyone, of course. But I think without the support, without the place to go and learn, then and also the clear pathways, lots of different types of people getting the role. You just want to protect your IP. I think as things started to connect, and it's different maybe for coaches even. So coaches have had maybe 80 years of research, I think maybe 60, 80 years of research. There's been knowledge exchange, there's been platforms, but even now, some coaches like don't want anyone watching training at all. So, for sporting directors to not have that base of research, that the decades of connection and knowledge exchange, but to be so open and supportive of each other is it's mind-boggling, really, if you put it in that perspective. So I think a number of things have happened. These guys have been exposed to very different types of organizations. So some more traditional football setups, some investor-led setups from people from all around the world, some multi-club ownership groups. And I think they've acknowledged quickly that there's some real benefits in that competitive collaboration. So we collaborate, but it doesn't mean we have to put everything on the table. And it means we can still support each other without really weakening our own hand. And actually, in some cases, for the work that we do, we're not sharing what's going on the pitch and on the grass with our coaches. We're sharing how to deal with managing up or managing teams of people or how to get the best communication between a multidisciplinary team with competing agendas or competing egos. So those things like they're actually a little bit further away from the grass and things that people accept now that, yeah, we can We can work together, we can share ideas, and that for me is a credit to the those early innovators that set up the association. But not so much just the association, it was just that those platforms for discussion. So to be able to drive them and make them happen despite people maybe wanting to go against them or not engage with them, now it's just tipped the balance. And I think more recently, like, we hosted 19 technical leaders from Japan in Austria. We're speaking to, even today, speaking for leaders from Ecuador through to countries in Africa, countries in Europe. It's actually like these are quite, it's quite exciting times trying to join the dots and help people create new talent pipelines or get advice on working with agents and all this kind of stuff. Really, really exciting work.
It's interesting that you speak about innovation, and I would say you guys are really early movers in what is a relatively new market. What's been interesting to me from the outside, of course, if you look at the sporting director role over the last decade, you look at so many different routes into the role, i.e., from the recruitment background, the youth development lens, a player agent led, even if you look at the day-to-day behavior of a sporting director, or the difference between certain sporting directors being on the bench with the coach in Germany versus up in the stands traditionally, in England or elsewhere. As the Association of Sporting Directors, how would you guys come to define the actual role of sporting director and the key non-negotiable core tenets of that role too?
Yeah, so when I talk about it, if I'm really honest, there'd be lots of ifs, buts, some clubs, no clubs, it depends. But if you went for like non-negotiables, despite all the variations, there's three things that probably define a sporting director's experience and role. The first would be, and something I'm most passionate about is around strategic alignment. And I don't want to say alignment because that's an in term, but I think it's about really understanding what and helping the club understand or sharing with the club what the owners want, understanding what the club really wants to achieve. Okay. And then building systems for those decision making to reflect that club's identity, to ensure it's within the resources and helps deal with short-term needs and along that longer term strategy. So for me, that alignment is around that those areas, but then it would spin out to the two other most important. So strategic alignment, and the second would be talent management and then stakeholder management. And for talent, for me, that's not just about obviously players, that's overseeing recruitment, development and succession from academy to first team. It's players, it's staff, it's coaches, it's the people that make up these multidisciplinary teams. That overarching talent management, also like how do we develop that workforce too? That should all be aligned with that strategic alignment. So that impacts the talent and who you need in, because if you've got a strategy that needs to get you from A to C, but your staff have only got the skills and competencies to get you from A to B, that's a problem. That's a gap that you need to address, putting it simply. And the third one I mentioned was stakeholder management. And I think because we've got, and you might even take stakeholder management and spin it into micro politics. So I'm just trying to overarch it, Connor, and not be too tedious by saying, oh, it's everything. But you've got to be able to work with ownership and serve them. And sometimes that's them on the board, sometimes it's them separate to a board. Then you've got to look after your head coach, plus coaches, your players, and your fans. And you can't let them slip too much. You maybe at your peril, you don't engage with the fans enough or your players. But if you don't get your coaches and your head coach right and the owners right, that's a problem. It's a serious problem that's going to have a quick impact. So strategic alignment, talent management, and stakeholder management. So when I try to take this into like a theoretical view, because I know some people will want to try and write about it, make sense about it. Mintzberg talks about these managerial roles. So for me, the sporting director is like that integrator. So he's trying to align all these different functions, but he's also the buffer. So for me, they should absorb all the pressure from the board and the fans, for that is the short term external noise about instant gratification. And they've got to translate that for a head coach and their team to say, yes, we need to win. But at the same time, we've got to be realistic about moving forward with the strategy too. So balancing those off. So the integrator of bringing this alignment, but also the buffer for trying to look after all the micro politics and people. Over explaining that, right, Connor, in my
No,
head,
not at all.
it sounded clear, but those three things, and then they've got two big roles trying to integrate and protect, really. I think now we're not seeing enough, in my opinion, and some of my observations of sporting directors that really fight and are out protecting the head coach, because it's also such an evolving role. Everyone's in really precarious situations themselves, so we end up in a bit of a fudge of challenges and problems. If we deal with one challenge, we expose ourselves. If we don't deal with it, we're just maybe exposing others. So I see owners doing that. I see executives doing that. I see some sporting directors potentially doing that. Some head coaches potentially doing that. So that's when it gets really messy. I guess if you looked at Monchi at Seville, he kind of did it well with recruitment. So there was changes in people, but he kept the recruitment process steady. So you just kind of look for that. Might be your big strategic alignment is just getting that recruitment talent management right. And then around it, other things maybe can be more challenging. But if you get that bit right, it still looks after the owner from a financial perspective, some performance perspectives, and but maybe the coaches might pay the price at different points.
It's absolutely fascinating. Honestly, you could do a separate conversation on it too, Dan. But what's interesting to me is if you look at the pathway, the traditional pathway of people moving into the role of sporting director, they're coming from a substantiated body of expertise in one specified field. You go into the sporting director, as Dan Ashworth said years ago, it's connecting six, seven spokes on a wheel. So you can leave yourself pretty open to vulnerable. You can be pretty vulnerable all of a sudden. So I'd love to get your thoughts on kind of the difference between knowledge of and knowledge about, because the way you've just listed all roles and responsibilities there and over those three core tenets of the sporting director role, it's quite a lot. So for me, the traditional sporting director is probably the most agile one, right? You can't control everything, but you can certainly influence it.
The sporting directors themselves have really different views on this, Connor. And I've got my own view on it too, based on observations, conversations, and being amongst it. I believe that fundamentally, they need to be able to find the best players and find the best managers. And the ones that can do that, they can stand, once they've had success, they can stand a lot more confidently in front of owners and demand certain things. And whilst someone like a Dan Ashworth would say he doesn't recruit any players, the club recruits players and he oversees all the process, that's 100% true. There'll be other sporting directors that will say, well, I do recruit the players, and here's how much money I'm going to make you by doing what I do best, and I need to be left to do that. So dynamic. I think when sometimes when you're outside and you have a view of someone, we view people with the badges that we see. So if someone sees me, they'll go, oh, he's an academic who's somehow, maybe it's not worked out in academia, or maybe he made a brave choice to leave academia and he's ended up in football. But not really in football. He's in the association, he's not close enough, whatever. The reality is we never really know what people know. So someone might come in through an agent perspective and we think, ah, okay, they must be all about player recruitment. And then we'll see someone else from a regulatory perspective and we're thinking, yeah, they can't touch talent ID and recruitment. And in some cases, those would be true. And in other cases, they just won't be true. So when people are in and around the game, they'll build up a level of understanding, awareness, and expertise really quickly. And you do that when your job and your career depends on it, then very quickly you need to really understand the different types of injuries and what they mean. You need to be able to, in some cases, look at a scan with the experts, because you want to ask the questions, you want to better understand it. So your CPD is not just on the job, but you're also craving, because then you start to. So if I know you've had similar injuries, Connor, I'm on the phone to you. I'm saying, what does this look like to you? Can you talk through what you did? What did your player return look like? How did you manage this? And everything becomes quick fire MBAs in every bit of the game. So I'd hate to like bring it down. At the same time, I know I work with some of the top sporting directors that if someone comes into their domain and starts maybe trying to tell them what to do, they'll quite frankly tell them where to go to, and they will be very clear about boundaries and their role. But so that was a messy answer, but I think it so depends on the different personalities and people that are out there. If for me, my observations is that like in any leadership role, I think people have the capacity to learn and develop and step into these things. But like anything, like you've really got to respect experience and success. And if you look at markers of expertise, like anything, if do I want a first time out surgical expert to be operating on my knee, or do I want someone who's been successful for 40 years? Now, there's different evidence on that, but still, you kind of think, ah, take the. That maybe someone who's done 20 years, not 40 years. 40 years, they might be getting tired of it. But 20 years, yeah, okay, I'll take that before the 1 year experience. So we have that, and we've got to be critical of those experiences and hopefully find and champion experts. And that's who we want to be around and learn from. But being open-minded enough to learn from others coming through. So yeah, not answered that well, Connor, but.
No, you have, because it kind of leads to the next question and the next point in terms of, we speak about the product off the field. If you look at a product on the field equally, if you buy a player that's not going to fit your system, by definition, you're pretty misaligned. So, an awful lot of clubs then on off the field, what type of sporting director you recruit for the role. Alignment, for me, it's the biggest catch rate, or it's the biggest buzzword in football now. Because it's very rare and it has to be cherished. So, you work in this advocacy and you also work in this advisory role too, Dan. And, unfortunately, dealing with a few messes is just part and parcel of the job for yourself now. So, from the outside, what are some of the biggest mistakes that you see clubs make when they're chasing alignment and get it wrong?
I'll try and answer that one, Connor, but the first thing you said about alignment is really cliche, and I know I used it too. But sometimes with alignment, it's also a bit, I just want to share this, also being really practical too. So if I want to be a sporting director and I speak to an owner and they tell me, Dan, we're going to be playing youth, we're going to be selling players, I want to get some money out, I've got to like. You've got to decide whether you want to walk away or you want to deliver the job. And that's a, so you, for some alignment might be really understanding what the owner wants and delivering that for them. That's like, I would always say, find out what the owner wants, the investors, and deliver it for them. Then the question of where you can show your values and do things in a more effective way is how can you deliver for them? Sorry, it's not what do you deliver for them, but it's the how. So how can you take like mission objectives from an owner investor and say, right, you've got to trust me to leave. I will deliver this for you, but this is you're gonna have to leave it to do it my way. So your how still can protect people, but it's a how. So how do you take that mission objectives and so still get alignment for the owner, but you translate that into a different messages for the team. That's quite exciting from an alignment perspective. So, I mean, owners, investors are all going to say, we want to do this, we want to do that, but how do you translate that and protect your staff? So that buffer in the how is quite exciting. I think from a biggest mistake perspective, maybe because of seeing and being close to some of that is around this almost designing some of the role around personalities rather than processes. So been exposed to that a few times now, but certainly from when we've sat down with owners and investors, often they will say, can you get me a Dan Ashworth but cheaper, someone who's coming through? And they'll say, yeah, but as or I say, we're going, what is it about Dan that really excites you? And they go, oh, just recruits the best players. And I'll say, well, if Dan was sitting here, he's not going to say he recruits the best players. He'll find a head of recruitment and he'll support the process. So that doesn't make sense. And then they'll say, well, what about someone like a Paul Mitchell? And I'll be like, where are we going with this? And then you end up saying, what is it that you want to achieve? What is it that you want to get out of this? I mean, they're some of the better conversations. Sometimes people are just looking for an ex-player personality. And often that's just to protect the owner a little bit longer. Because if they make a bad decision with an ex-player, then it's the ex-player's fault. And it buys them, at worst, a year, at best, 2 years in their role. And then after that, they can invest a little bit more money and get more of a reputable sporting director. So that goes in roundabouts. So I would say clubs often appoint these individuals without like a clear model. So when they haven't got a model and they've just got a personality, you just get silos, it gets short term, and even in some of the clubs that look like they're being successful, it's not necessarily the case when you're in there. From a theoretical perspective, if you don't have this contingency fit, so aligning your structure, strategy, environment, we know that's going to be a problem. And we've probably all seen it in different industries and football, whether it's a supporter, whether it's been an observer or someone critically thinking about football or being within a club. You see that, and you know it's a mess straight away. So, what does that mean for sporting directors that should be able to do good things and avoid those mistakes? So, clear reporting lines is a must. They need to know what they can make the decisions on. And for me, they need to have data-informed processes, especially on player and head coach recruitment, that continues within the club beyond their tenure. So if you look at some of when you see chaos within clubs, like often people don't talk about them, and compare them to the systematic model of Brighton or the clarity in decision making, say at Brentford, or the systematic process, strategic work at Liverpool, and each of these, the clubs have clear governance, and it supports consistency in the leaders. Outside of that, like, you don't see a really strategic club with systems and processes going through absolute turmoil. There's usually a problem up there when you look at like an organizational theory perspective, whether it's structure, strategy, or environment, there's usually a problem, and that has consequences.
Absolutely fascinating too. And you mean getting back into the mantra of ASD, you speak about support, connect, develop. You know, the one thing non-negotiable in despite of any experience that you have in a sporting director role piece is managing up. It's always variable. We've seen over the last few years the rise of private equity funds, the rise of so many different kind of ownership structures coming to the mantle with so many new ways, you know, of being data driven. So, like so many processes being data driven from the academy to first team planning to recruitment, so on and so forth. So, in terms of managing up and leading those conversations, Dan, it'd be interesting to go a bit more in depth to some of the modules that you guys do in ASD around helping and support sporting directors on that.
Yeah, I think from an ASD perspective, we try to, one, provide some regular updates and support and reading and learning to everyone who's associated in the 900 plus membership. And then there's almost like a member journey that you can go on. So if you came in and you started, you could access performance advisory if you're in the job and you need support. Or you come into our Leadership Institute. Within the Leadership Institute, you can maybe start at ASD X or knowledge exchange program, and you get exposure to different ideas, important topics, issues, different types of speakers. If you want to know a little bit more, you go up the next level and you might do our ASD online education modules. So we have two of our modules out of those seven. That's introduction to the role of the sporting director, the skills and capabilities of a sporting director, and the next one that will be released this month is on recruitment. And those continue. So it kind of builds your knowledge base. And then as you go from there, people then will look at the alternative sporting director, MBA. So that currently, as we've redesigned from the pilots, we'll have 10 modules across 11 months in 2026. Again, we cover everything from becoming a sporting director and what that might look like through to finance, governance, strategy, leadership, some core things just to help people understand those big buckets that you'd kind of get on an MBA, but also things around like how do a lot of the words that I hear a lot about standards. So like, what is standards? How do we observe it? How do we see it? How do we set it? How do we change and improve it? What does that look like in an environment? So we've incorporated those modules too. So really applied. I would say that the best bit around that course is not just the modules, it's the exposure to industry, it's the mentorship, it's the career advisory, it's the care that goes into it. And if you speak to any of those guys, happy to introduce you, Connor. Like, I'm sure, and they have already, like, seen the value in that, which traditional courses just aren't providing the care. We've got some professors, we've got some top sporting directors that just care. And when they care about you, because they're trying to understand the person, the personal journey, the professional journey, trying to make an impact on that. So our team, our remit is how do we blow people away? And that's a real challenge. Because we've got people with lots of different roles and activities in their day-to-day life, but we've got one fundamental thing within our team and the sporting directors involved is that we're good people. So we're trying to use that to make sure that we double down on caring for people and then letting all the other stuff and the magic happen around it. So yeah, it's learn and work, but yeah, really enjoyable. And then we have exec membership, of course, where we've got some really specific learning. We've got events. We've got events all around the world next year. So yeah, there's a lot going on from a module, but also learning knowledge exchange perspective.
And as you said, it's fast moving too. You're in a brand new office in Liverpool today, just fresh off a flight back from Tanzania yesterday. But as someone like yourself, as you alluded to, I mean, you're doing an awful lot of the research. I mean, you're getting onto the grass, you're in the boardroom with these execs. You know, you spend an awful lot of time away from work with them as well. You know, just harboring those connections and, you know, sustaining frameworks for that, Dan. What do you think and how do you see the role evolving over the next decade or so, because you have been early movers in what has been a relatively new space.
Yeah, I think from like, first off, I think from my personal perspective, I would love to be doing more research. But when I was in a university, I'm probably doing more research than what I did when I was in the university just because of role demands. But I'm really trying to support people. So one of the first research projects we supported was Max Linehart, who's now working for the European Club Association, so he completed his MBA at Warwick. And I think one of I would view my roles is trying to support people that are in the game, trying to give them access to the right people and then help them write up the research and get it published. So I'm quite excited about supervising people within the game. So Max has done that, got a role at the ECA, one of our close collaborators with the association, so really happy about that. He'll go and have influence and impact, all about strategy, all about performance. Perfect story and journey so far. Really excited about him. But that would flip to one of the recent papers we're working on with a head of performance in the Premier League club, a top Premier League club. So again, I won't name that student yet because they start the journey. They might not wish me to, but again, it's about really understanding the head of performance role and where that fits in the sporting director journey and the strategy process and how they can like that would be research is going to be really important for sporting directors to understand what's going on in these head of performance roles and how better to do them. So those bits I'm quite passionate about because I want to learn myself, but I also want the ASD to be able to inform with some credible stuff. I think for the role and moving forward over the next decade, some of this doesn't attract me whatsoever as someone who loves football, but it's definitely more it's going to be more corporate, it's going to be more global, and there's going to be a lot more data. So each of them excites me and doesn't excite me in equal measures, if I'm really honest. I think people maybe who would really benefit from it being more corporate will be say how exciting this is that we will see more global games and more vertical integrations and stuff like that. Kind of that doesn't really excite me. Like I want to see clubs with really strong local global identity, playing really good football with real clear identities that reflects the regions, but also some more sustainability, which I don't think some of this, some of the decisions we've seen. So from a corporate perspective, I think sporting directors need to have this financial literacy and governance skills to work with investors and boards and being able to influence and know when to stay in or walk away. I think from the global perspective, whether it's multi-club models formally or informally, it's about how can you manage these talent pipelines of players and staff across geographies and regulations. So the stuff we're quite fascinated is how we can support members to create MOUs between everywhere from Ecuador to mainland Europe, between J League clubs and Europe, J League clubs in South America, all these things that haven't been really strongly embedded. How can we support that in different ways? So that's the people have got to understand that. And then how this data is integrated. So I've seen some next level stuff, but I can't explain it because I don't know it well enough. But from my perspective, it's always this blend of how humans can use machine learning and AI. And I think that just goes into the human making the final decision, of course. I'm really fascinated by that and that ongoing process, whether it's about restarting the game, whether it's about head coach recruitment, whether that's about player recruitment. The key things for me, nothing from a sporting director cap on, not an investor cap on, is how do I really understand my coach and everything that we do and how we play, et cetera, with data. How do you understand other coaches to find the best coach now and in the future? And the same with players. And I can get data houses that I understand and that I trust, and I can communicate that to an ownership and board. That's the most powerful thing for a sporting director. So I think that needs to happen now. Like, and if it's where it is, those guys are feeling the benefits of it. Where it doesn't, it's a problem. It's a problem. From a leadership perspective, I think the sporting directors is going to have to almost span different boundaries of governance, regulation, AI, research, finance, science, so R&D. So they've got to understand these bits, going back to your question earlier. And know enough to ask challenging questions, know enough to be curious with intent, but not necessarily have to be experts within them. So know enough and have the process in place to find the experts. And yeah, I think with that it's hard not to go back to the City Football Group at the minute. So they have share methodologies, they have player movements across clubs, they have some staff movement, they have across their network. If you rated the quality of those networks, there's probably areas that need strengthening across the way. But for us, for sporting directors, that raises questions about like what is the identity of you and your club? And then really importantly, if you think if you want strategic alignment, talent management, and that final one, stakeholder management, like it's okay saying we understand our identity, but is it fair? And is it fair to all your stakeholders? So yeah, okay. If for example, a multi-club ownership had a Premier League club but decided their Italian club was more important in that network, there's very little like, well, that's going to create big problems for fans and stakeholders. So again, what does that mean for a sporting director coming in? So look, I don't think that particular case would happen, but yeah, really interesting around identity and fairness and the sporting director. Like it's your career, it's your life, your reputation. You want to go into clubs and be able to really fight for that identity, really fight for fairness and do the best possible job, which is difficult if your remit and from the owner is to do something else. So again, Yeah, interesting times.
Be fascinating to have had this conversation, Dan, just to lift the hood a bit more on the ASD. And you guys seem to be acting as such a conduit for connection and creating meaningful relationships between people working in, prominent roles within the game. And it's been a conversation I've really, really enjoyed. So just before we
Thanks,
end,
mate.
I mean, for those that are wishing to thread a similar path and that slightly bit inspired by this conversation, what would be the one bit of key advice you'd have for them?
I think anyone who's met me, this is probably like, oh, Dan, wind it in, because I say it all the time, but you can't just build your knowledge up in isolation. It's not enough. You need to build these networks. And I always go back to the research by Granovetter. So it's this idea of strength for weak ties. So it shows that in your career, so let's just say career opportunities, it often come through weaker ties. So those acquaintances that are not in your immediate circle, so the people beyond your immediate network or closer circle. So for sporting directors, plus anyone that wants to get on in football, this means not engaging with just in co coaches and scouts, but work with data scientists, psychologists, commercial partners. Like, look at Thiago Scudo now, AS Monaco, but CEO of football and business. Really fascinating bringing on all his expertise and experiences. So these diversity of networks and breadth of networks will shape your understanding. It will shape opportunities. It will shape your ideas and how you connect a talent that may hit all the markers that you know around research and playing and football and scouts. But if you understand the commercial media marketing side, the governance regulator side, you might view that whole scouting world completely different. So when I speak to our ASD members, very few have got a CV. Very few. And very few, even when they have a CV, won't have used it for the jobs that they've been invited to apply for. So what can we tell from that is that if we build these networks, we build our understanding, we build our knowledge at the same time. But it also allows people to better understand us. So it builds some forms of trust. I won't get into trust too much, but trust plus credibility, like we see, is one of the most utilized form of talent ID and acquisition, talent ID and recruitment of staff. So like if you ignore it, then you're gonna get less opportunities to get a job. So you've got to get your knowledge up and you've got to build your network at the same time. And whilst doing that, deliver. Be flipping, be bloody good at whatever you do, and then try and get outstanding expertise in whatever you do, and that will open the door for sure into wherever you want to go.
Really enjoyed today, Dan. Hopefully we can get around too. But Mr. Dan Purnell, thank you for coming on the show.
Connor, thanks for having me on, and yeah, next time maybe we'll do it over some food and some wine. But yeah, thanks so much for all the work that you've done for supporting the ASD and being an advocate, and also your podcast. I know you've interviewed so many leaders. It's such an effort and labor of love, but lots of inform, engage, inspire change, I'm sure, just because of your podcast, Connor. So thank you very much.